The following Future Conceive podcast is sponsored by the Virtual Education Committee of the Society for the Study of Reproduction, with the mission to develop virtual programs that will aid in the education, highlighting the careers of society members, bringing technology updates, and the latest scientific advancements in reproductive biology. Thank you for listening.
So I'm Monica Ward from the University of Hawaii, and I'm a representative of the SSR Virtual Education Committee. In 2021, SSR membership selected outstanding members for their annual awards. To let the SSR membership get to know our 2021 awardees better, we will be talking to them about their unique achievements in the reproductive biology field, about their ideas and concerns that they want to share, about their scientific interests and other topics. In 2021, Johnson Leadership and Service Award recipient is Bernard Robert. Bernard is a James McGill professor and holds two appointments, one in the Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics and one in Obstetrics and Gynecology, both at the McGill University in Montreal, Canada. Bernard was nominated for the award by Sally Perrault Darnay, whose last position was that of Editor-in-Chief of the Environmental Health Perspectives, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, NIH. As a nominator, Sally will be conducting the interview with Bernard. So Sally and Bernard, please go ahead.
Well, great. I'm absolutely delighted as a long-term friend and colleague of Bernard's to see him awarded, given this nice honor from the SSR. As you know, the Janssen Leadership and Service Award is intended to honor members who have contributed their leadership talents and time that go well beyond their immediate laboratory research activities, such that they support and influence the larger scientific endeavor. Certainly, you, Bernard, have done this in a variety of contexts. And in this webinar, we'll explore your thoughts on leadership and service, starting with your many contributions to SSR and other related societies. So to get started, can you tell us how you entered the field of reproductive sciences and came to join SSR over 40 years ago, and what has kept you here?
As an undergraduate, I became very interested in the population growth that's occurring on this planet. And I was a member of the ZPG group in California, Zero Population Growth in California. But then when I went for graduate studies, it was very hard to find groups doing research in contraception. And so I did my PhD in neuroscience at McGill in pharmacology. Towards the end of my PhD is when I decided, okay, I've got to find a place where I can do reproduction research and try to come up with a contraceptive. And looked at many labs and ended up moving to Johns Hopkins to work under Larry Ewing for my postdoctoral studies. And I've been in that field ever since. It was a wonderful decision to work in a great environment at Hopkins. And I've kept many friends in those days.
I know you've been very active in SSR, but also Testis Workshop and other fields. So what's special about SSR to you?
SSR is the first society I went to. 1976, I went to that meeting for the first time while still a postdoc. And I saw the leadership that Larry had and the range of exposure from male to female to reproductive tract. The fact that more than half of the members have always been very young student trainees. So it's a very dynamic society. It's a society that encourages young people to participate at every level. So very early on in my days at SSR, I was appointed chair of the nominations committee. And I've worked on many, many committees for SSR over the years. It's an opportunity to learn more. So I love the American Society of Andrology because it's all male, but it's narrow. The beauty of SSR is that you really get a broad exposure to male, female, reproductive system, neuroendocrinology, reproductive tract in both sexes, embryonic development. It's provides a breadth that's pretty unique.
Well, you've certainly trained many successful trainees, and they've gotten good jobs in not only academia, but also in government and industry. Can you share with us your philosophy of training students that includes teaching them about leadership?
To me, the most significant thing I've done in my career is to train students. I think the quality of the lab is based on the quality of the students and the environment they are in and what they do afterwards. My approach to training is to stimulate students to think on their own, to challenge them. I rarely answer a question with an answer. I almost always answer a question with a question. And I try to get them to look it up and think and discuss and come back. So the idea of learning to question, to be independent, to be critical, positively and negatively, and to always encourage them. So I've been writing letters of recommendation for people who were in my lab 20, 30, last one was 35 years after they left the lab. So they remain friends, it's like a family. And always positive support, but also being critical and underscoring when something is well done. So we often have lunches to celebrate papers being accepted. We have a big party at home every time somebody gets their PhD. Not in the last year because of COVID, but before that. But also pointing out all the mistakes along the way and trying to correct them and trying to make them better all the time.
And certainly that extends to their growth as people and as they become leaders too. So perhaps you could share with us some thoughts about what makes a good leader and how did you hone your leadership skills both in SSR at McGill and in influential positions within the Canadian government as well?
Well, I think it started way back in middle school, in junior high school. I was school service commissioner and class president. And I've been in sort of looking for leadership roles in my whole life. Certainly, the style of leadership I like to have is one where I bring people together, ask questions, and try to find out what the best solution is. I find that the style of the leader who says, I know it best and this is how you do it, doesn't work. You bring a team around a table, you face a problem, you say, what are the potential solutions? And you resolve leadership that way. You resolve problems that way. So I can tell you when I was the Associate VP Research at McGill, we had problems every day. And the most common use of my office was to have a round table and bring people in and say, okay, you guys disagree. There's a problem here. Let's figure it out and let's resolve it. And that applies to research also. So I've been part of team grants or leading team grants for the last 30 years. We've been pretty much continuously funded for some kind of team research over the last 20 years. And previous to that, I had worked with a team at Hopkins. And the way I set those teams up is by figuring out what the question is and then bringing diverse people together around the table. So the idea is to provide breakfast, coffee breaks, and lunch. And you keep them in that room all day. And you just do brainstorming. And it's amazing what comes out when you bring people from different disciplines together around a question. And make sure that you don't have an agenda of you wanting them to do what you expect. You want to learn from them. And that's how it's really working well for us.
Well, you certainly explained that well. In my experience being on one of your team grants, I learned the term insectoral research. You can correct me on the pronunciation. I get that mixed up with insects. But can you define that for us? And particularly, I was very enthralled with your project on research to develop safe and sustainable plastics that drew from many disciplines. Maybe you'd like to share some of your project with us.
Sure. So most of our teams have been intersectorial. And the idea is that we bring together the expertise needed to address a question. And so let's talk about this plasticizer one. We felt that it's well established that phthalates are toxic, that there are many effects of the phthalates on the reproductive system. So one approach that we had, we considered, was trying to figure out the molecular mechanism of action of phthalates. But it's bad, so why bother? So the approach was, can we replace phthalates? Well, I'm not a chemist, I'm not a chemical engineer, but I have friends who are. And so I brought in some chemical engineers together, people who have been interested in plastics and making all sorts of different plastics. And with them, they designed a whole bunch of chemicals. They had the possibility of doing that. And then we had to test those chemicals, and we wanted to test them in vitro in different cell lines to test what could happen. So we brought in some cell molecular biologists together, and then we wanted to make sure that we could measure what was happening in clinical situations. And so we brought in some clinicians, OBGYN and urologists. And then there are ethical implications and business implications of trying to change the world of plastics. And so we brought in people from the business community and from the law faculty. And that sounds like a really hodgepodge of people. But you put them together in a room and you ask questions and things come out of that. And we've had some really nice experience coming out of that project. But we've done that again with replacement. So we now have a big project on trying to replace legacy chemicals like phthalates, like brominated flame retardants, like BPA. And again, we've brought in people from different areas, and that's going really well these days.
Yes, I know you've included people from Health Canada too, so you also have the government and policy voice at the table, which is great. I suspect that's one of your favorite accomplishments in the lab, but do you have other favorite findings and discoveries in your career?
Most of the most exciting discoveries I found are discoveries that when you first do the experiment and you get the results, you're sure you made a mistake. It just wouldn't be right. And your supervisor or your friends or your colleagues tell you it's wrong. And so that's happened several times. That happened when I first started working on phosphate reductase in the epididymis, and I was in Larry's lab, and people didn't believe what we were getting, but it was right. And it's happened time and time again. So the foundation for current hormonal approaches to male contraception are based on some of the work that Carrie and I did way back, and I followed that up over many years. The work that we've done on drugs like cyclophosphamide given to males, and the idea that the father can have altered sperm that can affect progeny outcome, was viewed as a totally stupid, illogical concept. Clearly in the 80s, when we first proposed that, everybody knew that it's only the mother who was responsible for what happened to the child. And when we first put a grant in to investigate that, we ranked at the very bottom of the pile. But we weren't discouraged. We applied to other agencies, and we got some seed money from March of Dimes. And we were able to show that, in fact, the paternal exposure to drugs can modify the sperm in a way that will affect progeny pretty dramatically. This is taken as dogma today. It was not in the 80s. And so after we got our first paper in Nature on the topic, we then went back to the same committee in Canada for that had turned us down, and we came out on top of the committee. So it says something about peer review. It says something about trying, when you do something that's really different, believe in it, stick with it, don't give up. If you think you're right, if you believe in your data, just go with it.
Well, I remember those days well, and meetings you organized when male mediated reproductive effects or developmental effects was a brand new term. And I think you were a pioneer in that field. Obviously, you have to publish your research for people to know about it. And I would be remiss not to bring up the fact that you, with Bruce Murphy, were editor of Biology of Reproduction. That was back in 2009 to 2013, which was a really formative time for the journal when we were moving to online publication. Computers were making submission and peer review into a much faster process and perhaps more demanding process for an editor. So perhaps you have some thoughts on the role of BOR as a society journal in today's world, which is highly competitive and changing rapidly, or perhaps something you might do differently if you were editor in chief of BOR today.
Well, the world today in publication is not what it was 12 years ago. We're challenged with a lot of predatory journals. We're challenged with a lot of really poor publications. So maintaining the high quality standard of our society journals is very important across all scientific societies. I think the current editors have done a great job. The journal is doing well. I think it's important for members of SSR to continue to publish with some of their best work in the society journals. And I'm very proud of BOR. What I would do differently today, I'm not sure because I'm not immersed in the editorship process. However, it is clear that reaching out in ways that are a little bit foreign to traditional journal publishing is important. So the idea of having short recorded videos associated with every paper, I think graphical abstracts are one small step in that direction, but making it more interactive, giving an opportunity to readers to ask questions of the authors directly, maybe having follow-up discussions a year or 2 years after the publication of a paper. I think that's how journals will continue to thrive and evolve and change.
Well, those are some great ideas. I couldn't agree with you more. Rather than continuing with a lot of questions, perhaps you want to bring up some issues, your philosophy and any other issues related to your career and to leadership and service to inspire the rest of us in SSR, especially the trainees.
We all have stumbling blocks in life. And I've had some, so it's not apparent from a voice recording, but I'm an albino with a very bad eyesight. The reason I bring that up is that when people have problems, the way you go forward is by facing those problems and surmounting them. So whatever physical or psychological problems you may have, just get over it, work on it, and move forward. The most important part of being a scientist, I think, is training new scientists, teaching, learning to excite them about science and about the future possibilities. We are on the brink of an explosion in science, and particularly in the biological sciences. We think we've done a lot in the last 20 or 30 years. Just wait. I mean, this is just beginning. where we're heading with things like CRISPR. And I just saw some amazing presentations in the last week at the American Society of Andrology of what they're doing. There are really some wonderful new concepts and methods being applied to our understanding of reproduction. So the future is very bright. I think there's lots of possibilities. Be excited. Support your trainees, and trainees support your professors. It's a team effort. And that's how you succeed. It's by working together.
Well, thank you so much for that, those positive words, Bernard. And we look forward to, we congratulate you on this award, and we look forward to many new discoveries coming from your group. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm very proud of having received this totally unexpected award.
This music is produced by Buck Hills and Perrette Hale.